From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 31 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, a clinical trial from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute shows that people with pre-hypertension who reduced their sodium intake by 25 to 35% had a 25% lower risk of total cardiovascular disease over the 10 to 15 years during which they cut back on salt. Special correspondent Belle Waring tells us about a clinical research trial she's volunteered for. The National Eye Institute marks Healthy Vision Month with some information on how to get yourself checked for glaucoma. There are some new insights into how cells repair their DNA that could point the direction to a possible way to stop or slow the onset of Huntington's disease. And we hear about the importance of HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, which is coming up on May 18th. But first, Wally Akinso shares a report that shows how having elevated risk factors as a young adult increases the likelihood of coronary calcium deposits later in life. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
Where will you find the future of science? Right here with us.
The students of today are the scientists of tomorrow. Will we be ready?
We are the future doctors and nurses, lab technicians, and scientists. We are the future of science.
Support science education in your local schools. The scientists of tomorrow need your support today.
Brought to you by the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services.
That public service announcement you just heard was recorded by a group of elementary school students who visited the NIH campus during Take Your Child to Work Day recently. In future podcasts, you'll hear the same message recorded by middle school and high school students. Moving on, if you needed one more reason to avoid the risk factors that lead to cardiovascular disease, Wally Akinso has just what the doctor ordered.
Having elevated risk factors as a young adult increases the likelihood of coronary calcium deposits later in life, according to a study by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Although on average, heart disease risk factors are less common in young adulthood, elevated risk factors at this age predict the development of later asymptomatic heart disease better than levels measured later when they are typically higher. Other studies have found that the amount of coronary calcium correlates with the amount of atherosclerosis or hardening of the coronary arteries and is related to the likelihood of developing heart disease in the future. Dr. Catherine Loria, lead author of the study, said they are learning more about the beginnings of heart disease and how to prevent it.
Another important finding was that risk factor levels of young adults in their 20s were just as informative as levels measured later of having coronary calcium, which suggests that we should begin assessing heart disease risk as early as possible.
In the study, coronary artery calcium was more prevalent among men than women and among white men when compared to African American men. Dr. Loria said young men and women should work with their doctors to learn more about their risk and then do everything they can to reduce it, such as eating a healthy diet and being physically active. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
You've heard all about the many benefits of reducing your sodium intake, preventing high blood pressure leading the list. Now, if you needed yet another reason to cut back on salt, new data from a clinical trial from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute shows that people with pre-hypertension who reduced their sodium intake by 25 to 35% had a 25% lower risk of total cardiovascular disease over the 10 to 15 years during which they cut back on salt. Dr. Jeffrey Cutler, NHLBI Project Officer of the Trials of Hypertension Prevention Program, also known as TOHP, said it's reasonable to assume that the reduction in heart disease risk goes hand in hand with the reduced risk of high blood pressure that results when a person reduces his or her sodium intake.
That's the logical interpretation. There are data both from animal studies and, human population studies that reducing sodium might have some benefits separable from its effect on blood pressure, but most likely the major chain of causation is through its effect on blood pressure.
Two of these TOHP trials were conducted in 10 clinical sites, one from 1987 to 1990, the other from 1990 to 1995, with follow-up for 10 to 15 years after each trial. This new follow-up data shows that the groups who reduced their sodium intake also had lower mortality from cardiovascular disease. Dr. Cutler said the news may even be better than it seems at first blush.
The levels attained in these randomized trials conducted in the late 1980s and early 1990s were substantial, but they were not even at the level what the guidelines recommended at that time. In fact, for much of the population, the guidelines are now recommending lower levels, in part because of another study that NHLBI sponsored, the DASH sodium study, which showed that for a given amount of salt reduction, the blood pressure reduction is greater in the lower range level than at the higher range level. So we're operating in TOHP for the most part in the range above the area where you get the maximum benefit. So it is very likely that this study underestimates the potential public health benefit.
The new data has been published online by the British Medical Journal. The last time special correspondent Belle Waring went to donate blood, she wound up getting involved in a clinical research study that could benefit us all. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Got a youngster around the house who's on the heavy side but is otherwise healthy? The National Institutes of Health would like to talk to you to see what they can learn from your child. Not only are all study-related tests and treatments provided for free, but all participants are compensated. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. You've heard the expression, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade. That's kind of what our special correspondent Belle Waring did the last time she went to donate blood. Here she is with a special report.
Donating blood is cool. It's a low-key way of saving a life. That's the purr of an NIH blood bank pump. And if you're a regular donor, its soothing sound becomes part of your life. But the last time I came in to donate, something happened when the nurse took a drop of my blood for the screening test. The test, which is painless, by the way, showed that my hemoglobin was too low for me to donate. Now, hemoglobin is the iron-containing protein that makes blood red and carries oxygen from the lungs to the tissues. So until my level came back up, I was to be deferred, temporarily turned away. I enjoyed coming around every 8 weeks and being part of the blood bank family, but this time, my blood wasn't up to snuff. That's when I moved from writing about research to being in it, as a volunteer in the NIH study called Iron Replacement or Not. Dr. Barbara Bryant, the principal investigator, is tackling iron depletion in the blood donor population, and this is the research effort she and her team invited me to join. As a clinical fellow in NIH's Department of Transfusion Medicine, Bryant is examining the safety and efficacy of giving donors oral iron supplements.
We have an iron replacement study here at the NIH where we're looking at giving iron to blood donors that have low hemoglobins and low iron studies. To donate blood, you have to have a 12.5 gram per deciliter hemoglobin level or higher. We like to confirm the low hemoglobin with a CBC and also check their iron studies to see if they're iron deficient. And if they're iron deficient, we offer them over-the-counter iron replacement tablets. And then we follow up with them 30 to 60 days later to see if they're eligible to donate blood.
Prior to enrolling someone in the study, Bryant carefully screens them to rule out serious conditions that may be causing blood loss. But donors are, for the most part, healthy, normal individuals. So if Bryant can determine if somebody is iron deficient and then determine the cause, she can help replace the iron. This is important because recruiting new donors is expensive, as high as $500 a head. The more donors the NIH blood bank can retain, the more patients it can help. and the Iron Replacement or Not study is the first of its kind.
Low hemoglobin in blood donors has been a subject of concern and discussion in the blood bank community for many years, but there has not been a large study to take a look at giving iron to these donors. There have been some isolated studies that have been done about giving iron to premenopausal women. But for the most part, studies looking at giving iron replacement tablets to any donor who doesn't pass hemoglobin screening, regardless of age or sex, has not been studied. It is unique because there are no other studies out there that have been published showing the safety and efficacy of giving iron replacement tablets to blood donors.
People can be iron deficient and not know it, Bryant says. They can feel fatigued or crave unusual substances, such as large amounts of ice. They may even develop secondary restless leg syndrome due to low iron levels. But with iron replacement, their symptoms can go away. They become able to donate again.
Donors are great people. They come in, they want to help people, they want to donate blood. Donating a unit of blood can help save three lives, you know, and sometimes even more. It may go to several babies. So donating blood is such a good thing. And to have people who get deferred wanting to do this good thing, but yet not having a way to fix the problem, I think this is a challenge to the blood bank community.
Good afternoon, NIH Blood Bank. This is Sparkle. Can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Being as a new donor.
For NIH Radio, this is Belle Waring.
May 18th will mark the 10th annual HIV Vaccine Awareness Day. It's an opportunity to reflect on the more than two decades of progress worldwide in the search for a safe and effective HIV vaccine. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases initiated the first HIV vaccine clinical trial in 1987. Since then, the NIAID has worked with its partners to conduct a variety of vaccine clinical trials that have enrolled more than 26,000 volunteers. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, director of the NIAID, commented on the importance of setting one day aside each year to focus on HIV vaccine awareness.
First of all, HIV Vaccine Awareness Day is important for a number of reasons. First is to make people aware of the importance of vaccines in the broad approach towards the prevention of HIV. There will be no single modality that will be absolutely preventive of HIV infection, particularly in situations in which there is risk behavior going on or in situations in which people are not even aware that they're practicing risk behavior. There are so many modalities of prevention. Vaccine is key among them. So the first objective is to get people to be aware that we have still not reached the point where we need to be in our comprehensive approach towards the prevention of HIV infection. The other importance of HIV Vaccine Awareness Day is to get people aware that they can contribute by participating as normal volunteers in any of a number of vaccine trials that will be rolling out over the next several years. We have had enormous success over the years, not only in HIV research, but in research in any discipline, in the careful and safe use of people who volunteer for clinical programs so that knowledge can be gained that might be helpful later on. So we're telling the public, pay attention to what's going on. This is a very important component of the HIV infection prevention comprehensive plan. And if you see fit, if you have the opportunity, you should consider participating in a trial.
Dr. Fauci said another reason for observing HIV Vaccine Awareness Day is to point out the importance of healthy volunteers in the search for safe and effective HIV vaccine.
Well, first, I would explain to them how important this is to global health. So if individuals want to make a contribution to the broad global health, of which HIV infection is a major negative component of that. If you look at the global diseases that are killing so many people, there's HIV, there's malaria, there's tuberculosis, there's neglected tropical diseases, and then there's many of the diseases that we ourselves see, for example, among children in this country. So there are so many diseases of which we still have not gotten the final answer. So if an individual says, I want to make a contribution to global health society, I want to feel that I've done something that is a contribution, why not consider taking part in a vaccine trial for HIV?
The NIAID works closely with several organizations in the fight against AIDS. These organizations include the NIAID HIV Vaccine Trials Network, the U.S. Military HIV Research Program, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and other groups within and outside the United States. In addition, Dr. Fauci said local communities play a key role in HIV vaccine research.
Well, sure, because we know that whenever we get action on things like clinical trials, it's the mobilizations in the local community. Community leaders, community people who want to contribute to society, they're the ones that mobilize these drives to get people on studies. So it is so much better to get buy-in from the community level. You get a degree of credibility. You get people who understand what they're doing. They get well-educated into what they're getting themselves into because they're hearing it from the people they trust, their community leaders.
Dr. Peggy Johnston is the director of the Vaccine Research Program at the Division of AIDS at the NIAID. She said there has already been significant progress made in HIV vaccine research and that scientists believe it will be possible to develop an effective vaccine.
There has been significant progress made. We have learned a lot more from natural history studies about how the immune system controls this virus, and we're now taking that information and applying it to new kinds of vaccines. Specifically, our classical vaccines mount an immune response so that when the virus comes in and begins to replicate, that immune response can completely clear the virus and protect the person from infection. But HIV offers us many more significant challenges than the typical virus, because when it comes in, it can get inside the host cell and get inside the DNA and stay there and remain hidden from the immune system within probably weeks of exposure. So the window of opportunity we have for the immune system to clear the virus is very short, and much shorter perhaps than for other viruses for which we have more classical vaccines developed that completely prevent infection.
Dr. Johnston said research has led to a better understanding of a specific type of immune response in the body known as T cells.
We've learned about these T cell responses and how they can help control the infection in infected people. So what we're testing now in trials are vaccines that induce strong T cell responses that we will give to people before they become exposed. And then even if they become infected, we are hoping that these T cells do what they did in animal models, which is help the body control the levels of virus down to low levels so the person remains disease-free for a longer period of time and lives longer without having to go on antiretrovirals.
Developing an effective vaccine depends on collaboration among academic, private sector, and government researchers, non-government organizations, and thousands of volunteers who are committed to the fight against AIDS. For more information on how you can join the fight and be one of the generation that ends AIDS, visit www.bethegeneration.org. When we come back, we'll hear some suggestions from the National Eye Institute that could help you prevent the permanent damage caused by glaucoma. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it,
wouldn't you?
At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. More than 4 million Americans have glaucoma, an eye disease that damages the optic nerve and destroys sight. About half of those people aren't even aware they have the disease. There are no symptoms, according to Dr. Ann Coleman, chair of the Glaucoma Subcommittee for the National Eye Institute's National Eye Care Health Education Program.
If you rely on a high eye pressure, you're not picking up everybody, right? Because only one out of two have high eye pressures, and they may or may not have glaucoma. If you're relying on the visual acuity where you read the vision along the chart, you're not going to pick it up because that's your central vision. And glaucoma hits your side vision, your peripheral vision. And so they really need to go in and have someone look at their optic nerve. What they do is they take special lenses, and we can see the nerve when we look in the eye. And that's most often recommended to be done with a dilated eye exam where we put drops in to make the pupils big, so we can see in better.
The NEI encourages people at a higher risk for glaucoma to get a comprehensive dilated eye exam every 1 to 2 years. Those people would include African Americans over age 40, everyone over age 60, and anyone with a family history of the disease. Dr. Coleman said early detection and treatment is key in preventing permanent vision damage from glaucoma.
We know that if we get the pressure down, if the pressure's normal, we just get it even lower, that we can slow down or prevent any vision loss. We can use medications to do that, which are eye drops, sometimes pills. Then we can also do laser surgeries, and we also have regular incisional surgeries where we can make like a little trap door in the eye to let the fluid out, or we can even put like a drainage device, which you could describe as like a hose that drains some of the fluid out of the eye and lowers the pressure.
May is Healthy Vision Month, during which the NEI encourages all Americans to make vision a health priority. Finally, Wally Akinso has this story about how insights into the body's healing mechanisms could lead to new ways to slow down the onset or progression of a serious disease.
New insights into how cells repair their DNA could point the way to a possible way to stop or slow the onset of Huntington's disease. According to a study funded by the National Institute of General Medical Sciences, the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
Huntington's disease is an inherited condition affecting roughly 30,000 Americans.
It causes certain nerve cells in the brain to waste away, causing such problems such as uncontrollable movement, clumsiness, or balance problems. Dr. Jeremy Berg, director of the NIGMS, discusses the importance of this discovery.
What the paper reports is that a pathway involved in DNA repair seems to be responsible for genetic changes which are seen in Huntington's disease. What's most remarkable about it is one particular DNA repair enzyme that seems to be solely responsible, which has both implications for understanding the nature of these genetic changes, but also has potential therapeutic implications longer term.
The study shows that the inserted segments grow when cells try to remove oxidative lesions, which are caused by byproducts of the oxygen we breathe. DNA enzymes initially keep oxidative lesions in check, but over time, increasing numbers of lesions overwhelm the repair systems. Dr. Berg said, while scientists have long suspected that oxidative lesions play a role in Huntington's disease, the specific role of the lesions had remained elusive till now. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, May 18th, when episode 32 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the Health Star Radio Network, and online at www.federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. That email address, ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, that email address is ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.